And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Today's theme is mindset. Each of my guests is discussing the impact of one's mindset on one's performance. My next guest is living proof that you can change your mindset and succeed. We'll be talking to David DeStenno, who is the author of the book Out of Character. Now, my next guest is the director of Social Emotions Lab at Northwestern University. He examines the truth behind the liar, the cheat, the sinner, and the saint lurking within each of us in his latest book, Out of Character. David DeStenno is the associate professor of psychology at Northeastern University, where he is also the director of the Social Emotions Lab. David has served as a visiting associate professor of psychology at Harvard University. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Scientific American, and he's been on ABC News and NPR. He's also guest blog for the New York Times Freakonomics blog. Welcome to the show, David. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for being our special guest. We greatly appreciate it. And I loved your book, Out of Character. I'm always fascinated by the trips down the lanes of our own minds and how our minds work. So let's just start with the basic premise behind your book is that we all act out of character sometime. And let's look at some very, very famous examples. I'm going to start with Tiger Woods. Now, he was the poster child for professional golf, model family, beautiful wife, wonderful children, and then he's caught cheating on his wife. I mean, why do people behave this way?
Well, it's a good question. And before I get to Tiger, which I'll get to quickly, I think you've hit the nail on the head. The main premise here is that it's not just celebrities, it's not just people like Governor Spitzer or Tiger Woods that do things that shock us. These same mental mechanisms are reside in each of us. But in the case of like Tiger, what we argue is that within the mind there are dueling sets of mechanisms, some that favor short-term outcomes, some that favor long-term ones. And it's always trying to find a balance between these two. And sometimes, due to no fault of your own, so to speak, different situations can ramp up one side or the other. So somebody like Tiger, we know if you survey the psychological research, things like hormonal states, things like the attractiveness of other people, things like how you're feeling when you're considering something that might be morally questionable can really change how you ultimately decide what to do.
Oh, it's interesting. And you brought up Elliot Spitzer. He was on my list of people to ask for because yeah. He's so amusing. He was a crusader against prostitution when he was in office in New York, and yet he's caught as one of the world's most famous Johns participating in prostitution. I mean, how does a person do that?
Well, that's right. It's the classic example of hypocrisy. You know, he's going to be stuck with the moniker Client Number 9, I think, for the rest of his life. But again, what is happening with most people is that there's always this desire at some level for, you know, expedience or what's good in the short term. And so you might think, well, how could Elliot Spitzer do this? But in actuality, the same processes are in each of us. And let me tell you how we know this. What we do in our lab is we bring regular people in, and we don't ask them, would you ever be a hypocrite? Because nobody's going to cop to it, and most people would never assume that they would be. But we'll do experiments like the following. We'll come in and we'll say, you know, there are two tasks that need to be done, a fun one and a really onerous one. Here's a coin to flip to decide whether you get the fun one or the next guy does, and then we leave them alone. 90% of people will not flip that coin. They'll just say they did and assign themselves the good task. You might think, well, all right, that's not great, but it's not terrible. If you ask them how did they act, they'll say, oh, it was okay. But if they watch somebody else do it, they will crucify them for it. The essence of moral hypocrisy, right? Right there, the human mind will rationalize its way out of it, given 30 seconds to think about it, why it was okay for you to take the short-term goal. Now, if you do this too often, in the long term, it's not good for you. People are going to label you a hypocrite. But if you can get away with it once in a while, it kind of reinforces the behavior.
Oh, an interesting experiment. We're talking to David DeStenno, author, co-author of the book Out of Character, Surprising Truths About the Liar, the Cheat, the Saint, and the Sinner Lurking in All of Us. Well, if there's one thing that it's interesting out of your book, we look to our leaders, our parents, our politicians, our church leaders, our teachers, to have quote-unquote good character, whatever that is. If anything is apparent from reading your book, it's that character is fluid. So what are the tricks to managing the spectrum of our character?
Yeah, the primary trick is to realize that it's not what everybody tells you, right? Character is not learned early in life and then stable thereon. Because most people think, well, if I have good character, I'm not going to do anything bad, or I'll be able to resist the temptations. And what we're showing in this research is that it's not all about willpower. It's not all about intention. There are lots of elements in the situation you're in that can tip your scale, so to speak, one way or the other. You know, most of us, when we're deciding, should I do something or not that's morally questionable, we don't have really well thought out, you know, moral philosophies. We kind of do a gut check. And if you enter a situation and you're feeling really happy, suddenly many things are going to seem more okay. Why? Because your gut's feeling happy. When you do that gut check, you're not going to get that negative impulse that says, hey, what you're doing is not so good. And so things like that, things like subtle changes in the way other people look or the way other people move, all of these things can work below our conscious radar to affect how we're going to treat them.
Well, it's very interesting, David. So in everything that you've discovered and everything that you've done in your research, character and then by extension morality is fluid. So our moral compass doesn't always point to true north, as you say. So how did you conclude that morality is relative?
Well, you know, I want to be careful there, because what Pier Carlo and I argue is not that we're not advocating moral relativism, right? I think what morality is, what any person is going to judge as good or bad, is not in the realm of science, right? That's for them and their ethical philosophies or their religion to decide. What we're trying to do is tell you biologically the way the system works. And biologically, sometimes expedience can be a good thing, can serve you well in terms of, you know, genetic fitness and the like. And so what we're trying to do is tell people, here's the way the system really works. You can't assume it's all about just rational control. And once you accept that, then you gain greater control over guiding, you know, your ship of character, so to speak, as you want it to go.
Ah, an important distinction. We're talking to David DeStenno, co-author of Out of Character. And David, let's turn back to some of our real-life examples and ask you about the science behind some of the things that people do. And I'm going to turn to Mel Gibson. You know, he turned out to be a racist and a xenophobe. So what are some of the common psychological roots of racism and xenophobia?
Well, it's an interesting question. For a long time, people assumed that racism and xenophobia was something that had to be learned. And, you know, it can be. If you grow up in a situation where your parents and people that you care about are always telling you that a certain group is bad, well, then you may grow up feeling that way. But what we've been able to show is that prejudice can emerge really just from thin air. Again, looking back evolutionarily speaking, historically, when there's any conflict in an environment, who's it more likely to come from, people in your group or people from another group? The other group, more than likely. And so in our lab, if we make people feel angry, or if they feel fear, what that does is it kind of biases the automatic calculations that their mind goes through when it meets someone. And so when you first see someone who's from a different group, if you're feeling angry, the brain treats that as a signal that there's some conflict likely in the environment, and it's more likely to come from this person because they're different than you. And to show how deep it goes, we'll do things like bring people into the lab and put different color wristbands on them. So if you're wearing a blue wristband and somebody else is wearing a red wristband, if I then make one of you angry, you're going to judge another person as much more suspicious, much more negatively, if they have the opposite color wristband. Again, because it's a very subtle marker that they have some different purpose than you.
Interesting research. We're talking to David DeStenno. David, now let's talk about triggers. You just talked about anger as being one of them. Everyday things like television shows, perfume, hormones, even the surroundings where we are triggers to our behavior and they cause us to do things that we wouldn't do otherwise. How do these triggers impact our behavior for better or for worse?
Sure. So, for example, if you look at hormonal cycles, and we'll talk about women instead of men only because the hormonal cycle varies a bit more, The revealingness of the clothing that women will wear changes as a function of fertility cycle. The attractiveness of men to women and vice versa will also change as a function of sex hormone changes. And so what that means is any one person who normally might not act a certain way, in that instant, when the hormone levels are just right, they may dress slightly more revealing, they may flirt just a little bit more, and that may be enough to, you know, change what's going to happen to them that night when they're out.
Now, does it lead to, is it causal like that? Does it directly lead to changes in behavior, or does it just open up the possibility for changes in behavior?
Yeah, I mean, all of these things kind of add together. It's all kind of, you know, probabilistic. That is, each element that affects our behavior in a situation, kind of, you can think of it as a scale of character, and each element like this puts another weight on one side of the scale, whether it's going to be a short-term or a long-term behavior that we're going to engage in, like cheating or not. And when you have enough of them on the scale, they're going to tip it. So that's why it's very difficult to predict ahead of time whether you're going to succumb to one of these quote-unquote character flaws. And what we're trying to tell people is, be aware of what can go on in the situation. Don't assume that by willpower alone you're going to be able to control what's going to happen. And so if you enter a situation forearmed with knowing what can happen, you have the greater ability to manage what's going to happen on the back end.
We're talking to David DiStenno, co-author of the book Out of Character, Surprising Truths About the Liar, Cheat, Sinner, and Saint Lurking in All of Us. And let's talk about the seven deadly sins, if we can, for just a moment, David. The seven deadly sins, we all know them, but pride is the seventh sin. Pride can easily turn into hubris. However, pride can also be a good part of our character, too. How do you make pride work for you?
Sure. You know, pride's got a bad rap, but realistically, it can be quite useful. So, for example, what we've shown in experiments in the lab is that if we make people feel proud of anything, even very subtle things like can you count how many red dots can you count on the computer screen within 10 seconds, if people get praised for this, it motivates them to work harder. Why? Because normally what you get praised for are things that are valued by those around you. And people who excel in abilities that are valued are going to lead a much more optimal life. And so what we've shown with pride is that it will make you work hard. It will also make you more attractive to others, and they're more willing to follow you while you're giving off those pride cues. And so if the pride you're feeling really reflects a true ability, it can be quite adaptive.
All right, that's great. We're talking to David DiStenno. David, one of the other things that I found really interesting is you examine the compassion-cruelty continuum, and you conclude that how we react to both compassion and cruelty is basically based on how worthy we feel. So tell the story about the Christmas armistice of 1914 and how that really exemplifies both cruelty and compassion.
Sure. There's a famous story from World War I where the British and the Germans were fighting at a front, and it was a fairly vicious battle. And then Christmas Eve, the fighting stopped, and they started seeing lights appear on each side of the no man's land. And very rapidly, the men came out of the trenches, and they were suddenly singing Christmas songs and exchanging pictures with the men who, you know, a day ago, they were trying their best to kill. And the question is, how does this happen? And what work with Pier Carlo Valdesoldo has shown is that the compassion we feel toward other people, how much of their pain we feel, is really a function not only of what they're feeling, but of how similar we are to them. And so when these soldiers reframe their view of the Germans that they were fighting not as their enemy but as fellow Christians, suddenly they viewed each other as on the same team, and they felt each other's pain, and they came out and celebrated together until the high command forced them to stop. And we have experiments in the lab where we can manipulate, again, very subtle cues of similarity by, like, example, you know, colors that people wear. And people will go much more out of their way to help somebody if you're wearing the same color wristband than if you're not.
All right. Well, David, let's continue along those same lines. How did somebody like Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler rationalize the distinction between compassion and cruelty in their own minds?
Yeah, well, once we're talking at that level where we have individuals who are mass murderers and at some level, you know, sociopaths, we're talking about pathological minds. We're talking about minds that are not subject to the normal functions that most of us have. And so I wouldn't want to generalize these types of phenomena to that level of behavior.
Very good. We're talking to David DiStenno, co-author of the book Out of Character. David, why did you write Out of Character now, of all times?
Well, you know, Pier Carlo and I have been working together for a while, and after about 7 years worth of work on, you know, over 2,000 people, what became clear in all these experiments was just how variable people's behavior was, how people would, you know, behave much more altruistically than they ever thought based on certain very subtle situational cues, or how any of us could, you know, act as a hypocrite or become jealous without not even, you know, expecting it. And what that led us to think is that maybe the commonly held view of character that most of us have just really isn't correct. And so this book was our attempt to kind of bring it all together in a very accessible volume that presents the science but also does it in a way, you know, using examples that most people are familiar with.
All right, David, what do you want readers to take away from reading Out of Character? What are the top two or three things that you think of?
The top things are one, to realize that what you may believe about character isn't true, that it is much more variable than you'd ever think. The reason why people don't change that much day to day is because their situations don't. But when their situations change, their latitude of behavior is going to be a lot greater than anybody would think. And second, it's also the case that we want people to feel like there is some control over this. When we present this research, people oftentimes get dispirited, but we're not trying to dispirit people. It's not that things are random. It's that they follow scientific principles. And if you know what those principles are and how the system works, you actually can exert some control.
All right. That's a valuable lesson to learn. We've been talking to David DeStenno, co-author of the book Out of Character, Surprising Truths About the Liar, Cheat, Sinner, and Saint Lurking in All of Us. Now, David, if people are intrigued by the research that you've done, they want to learn more about your findings, learn more about you and the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
They can go to our website. It's www.outofcharacterbook.com, and there's the blog there as well as an excerpt from the book and the options to order it if they are interested.
Outofcharacter.com.
No, outofcharacterbook.com.
Book.com. Outofcharacterbook.com. That's an important distinction. Outofcharacterbook.com. David, thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.